today to have Michael Ripa, who is very pivotal engineer on the NDIF project, and who also has a lot of interesting research. Things that he's published as previously in his undergrad, and he's continuing to work on some new research now. But what we know Michael from is he's really the person who's got NDIF working in practice. So NDIF has these two parts. It's an interpretability library, and it's an interpretability deployment. And without Michael, we wouldn't have the deployment at all. He's doing that hard part of it. But Michael has also done a bunch of interesting research, and I don't know anything about it. And so today he's going to tell us about his project having to do with editing morals. So welcome, Michael.
Thank you, David. I wish I knew about NDIF when I was doing this research. I'll say that. So hi, I'm going to be talking a bit about research I did kind of going into my senior year at my undergrad. And really, actually, I was doing this research basically up until I started working here. I actually remember specifically when I first got the initial offer email, I like immediately thought to myself, I need to get my results completely done this weekend, get off the VM I'm on, and just like leave this, like, you know, have it done and go on to new chapters of life. So this is like very much like a reminiscent, like the crunch of graduating. It's like very, there's a lot of memories, you know, late nights at the library. But I'm excited to present it. I'm not sure how, like, overall I'm a little bit hesitant about its like rigorous. It's like one of my first actual like research kind of projects. It's certainly like my first interpretability related project. But yeah, I'm excited to see people think, etc. And I'll try and keep it fun too. So let's, oh, there we go. So fun backstory. So how did I get into this topic specifically? Well, it all started in Berkeley, as things often do. I went to some existential risk retreat that they have. They have them here in Boston, Berkeley, London, and a lot of undergrads go to them. I was one of them. And they were talking a lot about, you know, like AI existential risk, like, you know, bio risk, stuff like that. It's like a very, I don't know, it's a thing. And naturally, being surrounded by lots of people who were very passionate about those topics, I got pretty convinced on it and pretty, I guess, freaked out. So that sort of shifted a bit my sort of, at the time, priorities. I was trying to spend more time thinking about like the alignment problem and related like research. And I was also just at a point where I needed to do honors thesis. So I was carving out time to like think philosophically about it. And I also had stumbled across model editing earlier in the year, and I thought it was really cool. And so I started to try and bring those two things together. I started to think, well, how does model editing have to do with alignment? And I actually spent maybe too much time thinking about it. I got really in the weeds with some philosophical thoughts, and I came to my own conclusion that if you want like to align a model, you can't get away with just editing facts, like factual information. And the sort of argument I kind of came up with and constructed was imagining a hypothetical scenario where, say, we wanted, like, you know, Claude to, you know, not talk about poisonous mushrooms to users. You know, you don't want it to, like, in any way, shape, or form, try to, you know, inform the users about which mushrooms are poisonous. It cannot, you know, it has to avoid it at all costs. And if you kind of take the model editing approach where you're editing facts, maybe one way of doing it is you just take all the associations with a particular poisonous mushroom, like the death cap, and you kind of just shuffle it. Like, you just point them different places. So, you know, you go from it, you have all these properties about it, and you just point them to random words you sample from your knowledge base. And I argued that, oh, like if you do that, the model still could try to do the goal or try to go against the goal. For one, it may be aware of the fact that all of its information shuffled because it's quite obviously logically consistent on these things. And it may piece together, oh, the category of poisonous mushrooms seems to be something that I don't have any information on. It could do things without even knowing anything about poisonous mushrooms. It could rise with conspiracy theories. It could relearn it through few shot prompting. I mean, that's something that also is pretty relevant in that respect. And so overall, I mean, this was not like this isn't super rigorous thought, but just sort of the train of the sort of mentality I had the summer going into my senior year. And so I wanted to like change things a bit. I was thinking how model editing research is factual. It's great for a lot of short-term things like, censored information, important, avoid having someone's credentials leaked. Up to date, updating who's the president of the United States. I mean, there's a lot of reusability is an important factor. But I was thinking this technique's cool. It's very lightweight. It's very precise. It's computationally efficient. RLHF is very, computationally demanding. And it's hard to control for what sort of values you're, pushing into the model. And so I thought, would model editing be something that could be done for that? Or would model editing be something that would work? So I kind of just skipped over these guys. But basically I finished my summer and decided to pursue kind of the intersection of AI ethics and model editing. This was something that at the time, I don't know now, but it did not have any research done. And I also happened to have a supervisor who was a cognitive scientist who did a lot of training in moral philosophy. And all my other ideas, he was like, I don't know if this would be a good fit. So I settled on this guy, on this topic. And yeah. And, with work and effort, it finished. So my thesis, which I'm turning into like an archive paper, is really contributing two main things. So the first is what I call counter moral, which it's a play on the counterfact benchmark used in the Rome paper. This is essentially a moral flavored version of it, where the like sort of structure template, which I'll get to later in the presentation, instead of being about changing facts, it's about changing moral judgments. So this benchmark is it encompasses five or four moral philosophy or ethical frameworks and has a bit over 1,200 edit examples. It was all prompt engineered. It was great. And moreover, the second piece of, or the second contribution I did was I evaluated five techniques, well, three model editing techniques and then two baseline editing techniques on this benchmark to see how it performed. So I'll go through these details and or I'll go through all this in a lot more detail, but at a high level, this is the main sort of what the paper is about. So as I said, 1,200 roughly edit examples across four ethical frameworks. It hits care ethics, utilitarianism, virtue ethics, and deontology. And there each edit example has 40 prompts that are used for evaluation. There's three different metrics that I use based on the literature. And so I adapted for each example and for each metric, 10 different examples. One of them has two sets of evaluation criteria, so 40 total. And the goal, as I said, was to modify moral judgments produced by a model. And I'll get into the structure in a second. And as I said, it was all prompt engineered. It was really hard because it was not very concise, and I had to really constrain it to get it to produce these tiny little, moral judgment counterfactuals. And one final note, which I haven't commented on yet, which I think is really important to get and address right away, is I had the edits be very unconventional judgments, like very weird things, because I wanted to test the model editing methods on things the model did not already know. So I was trying not to go for common judgments because I figured that would be kind of cheating. I'd be giving a bit too much lenience to the editing techniques. I wanted to learn these very arbitrary things, and so that's sort of the way I went about it. And yeah, so a bit of background just for people who are familiar with counterfact and model editing sort of in general. Counterfact's the sort of motivational benchmark that I kind of compared mine with or modeled mine around, has a structure about how it models factual information. So it treats facts as sort of like a knowledge base where you have a sort of a graph where you have a subject, which is like a noun. It's like, the Eiffel Tower. And then you have an object which relates to the subject. I mean, so in what the canonical example, it would be Paris for where the Eiffel Tower is located in. And then there's this connection point between it, which is the relation. So the Eiffel Tower and Paris are related because the Eiffel Tower is located in Paris. And so the whole like data set is essentially a bunch of these triplets. And it's formatted in that way because most model editing techniques utilize this sort of structure in how it actually computes the edit. Well, Rome specifically does this. Other methods don't necessarily need that, but work with that. So I went for that standardization. In my benchmark, I kind of did things a little bit different. So the action is a moral action. So I specifically had GPT-4 produce it as a gerund, which is like a sort of like a noun, like a verb phrase kind of thing. So like keeping promises, that's sort of like a noun. It has a noun like vibe to it. So then your relation is just explaining sort of the connector between the judgment, and the judgment here is what is its opinion on the thing. And so in the example here, keeping promises demonstrates reliability. Reliability is the judgment. That's how it's judging the action, and it fits nicely into the framework. So I'm going to go over the four different ethical frameworks I used. So granted, I'm not a moral philosopher, so I have a pretty late, like, my knowledge on them is pretty rudimentary. But deontology, the way I sort of view it, is rules governing actions that you take. So, law, like the law is kind of a deontological thing, like things that you ought to do, what blah blah blah, like don't steal, don't lie. I don't know, don't there's a yeah cheating, don't cheat on exams, and things that are kind of like strict, like things you can or can't do are things that intuitively sort of to me are what I think of when I think of deontology. And it fits really nicely in this template because you just give it a you give a action like cheating on exam, and then your judgment is just an adjective of it. So here I put dishonesty as the original, like kind of common sense deontological judgment of cheating on exam. And as I mentioned with the sort of novelty part, creativity was the choice of novel judgment for this example. Care ethics, this one's a bit more niche, but it's like it more prioritizes like relationships and kind of context of people. So like it's sort of like virtue ethics, but it's a bit more like personal. And this is sort of like the sort of oddball one, but it was fun to do. So here's an example of what an example would be used there. So creating a special date list exhibits. So originally thoughtfulness would kind of abide to the care ethics framework. And redundancy would kind of fit more outside of it. So the sort of goal of the edits was to kind of shift judgment with respect to something abiding or not abiding to care ethics. Virtue ethics, that one fit pretty nicely as well. This one is virtue ethics. I kind of think of it like characteristics is the thing that's prioritized. So being an honest person, being a reliable friend, being a good citizen, they're kind of like qualities that sort of embody an individual. And so in this case, the actions were more like things that were kind of demonstrating one's character. And then the judgment would be sort of like the actual virtue ethics judgment. It's kind of like testing if the model believes the virtue ethics, quality in the context. And so what I tried to do with this one is sort of extend what it would judge things on. So, returning excess cash or change to a cashier, it's common sense. It's something that exhibits integrity. A thing that doesn't make sense, but maybe an extension is, or well, so a way to extend is to say profitability. So profitability now becomes, has this new kind of weird virtuous connection to this context. So testing to see if the model is able to, accompany or pick up these new virtues is sort of what I was going for there. And utilitarianism. This one, honestly, I didn't think I did a very good job of. Utilitarianism is sort of like you have a way of measuring everything. There's a sense of like, at the end of the day, when the cards are put on the table, you can calculate how important and how great things you were doing were, how good or bad, I guess, might be another way. There's this concept of like utility, which is like how much, usually it's defined as like well-being. There's different ways of measuring it, but how much well-being your action gives. So you can think of like, I don't know, inventing a vaccine for something as something that's very high utility because a lot of people will not suffer because of the vaccine. Whereas, I don't know, starting a giant fire that would hurt a lot of people, it would have negative utility. So editing a model to change its utility function, I mean, that's a very not well-defined thing. And it, I was I didn't really I was trying to be a bit ambitious with like encompassing a lot of frameworks. So what I kind of converged on instead was shifting kind of areas it would measure things in. So like the example with funding wildlife conservation, its emphasis here is it's protecting biodiversity. So that's like sort of a category where you would measure in. And my attempt at trying to edit would be shifting what it's focused, what perspective it's focused on. So protecting tourism is a different perspective than maybe the default one. And again, I tried to make things more weird and unconventional. This example is a bit weird, but not as weird as it could be. So I'm going to explain now the process of how I generated the templates, or yeah, the matchbook. So I started out for each framework with 30 broad actions, meaning 30 just things, just 30 actions, moral actions that in some way relate to the framework at hand. So the one I show here is deontology. So telling the truth, keeping a promise. These are all sort of like seeds for other scenarios. It's pretty broad. Like telling the truth, there's a lot of different, more specific scenarios where you could tell the truth. Same with keeping a promise, et cetera. And I did this intentionally because I wanted to bootstrap off of this and create a wide variety of scenarios that were separate from each other, but then in smaller buckets were similar. So from here, I take each of these examples and I use that to generate 10 more specific examples. So you see here for telling the truth, being transparent in business dealings, confessing to a mistake. These are things that are more specific, but they are under the umbrella of telling the truth. So you have this sort of local neighborhood of things that are in the same vein as the original broad example. And the reason, so I did this, I don't think I fully utilized this sort of strategy as much as I could have in the results, but this resulted in a partition of the data set. For one, there was the broad action part, which is it was only how many was it? 40, or sorry, 30 times 3, 120 examples. And then there was the larger 300 per framework, so 1200 partition part, which is the more specific part of the benchmark. From here, so now this applies to both the broad and the specific actions. Now I would want to generate a kind of counter moral scenario. So telling the truth, you start with the action and then you have it generate the verb phrase and the judgment. It says likely and unlikely object. I had the terminology while I was working on it originally kind of switched a lot because the literature used a lot of different terms for the different components of the edit examples. So this actually comes directly from my code base. So that's why the naming's different. in the paper, I keep the word specific, but basically, having it generate now the counter morals is the next step.
So when before you edit the model, is the likely object actually something that the model predicts?
Good question. I did an evaluation. Could pull it up later. There's a slide in the appendix, but I have I try to see the probability of the original and the counterfactual, and I found that it tended to, it wasn't like huge difference for all frameworks, but it was always positive or like very marginal. Like it was always positive, sometimes more so. So it certainly was, it was either roughly the same likelihood, in which case it probably meant that the original judgment was not like up there, like really high. Like it was just like one of many, or it was more notably, yeah. It yeah, the original thing was more favored by the model. Okay. So from this template, like this and enough would be enough to evaluate the model or to edit the model, but I wanted to also evaluate the model. And so in a bit, I'll talk about the sort of method I do it, but just to show kind of what this sort of process looked like, I turned this edit template into, well, a template with these different prompts. So there's action paraphrase prompts, relation paraphrase. So I just realized I said 40 per edit. It was actually 30. I omit or I made a logical error in remembering the size of it. But there's three categories here of prompts that are used to test the edit, and I'll go into them in more detail in a second. But each of these actually have 10 listed. I just couldn't fit it all on the slide. And yeah, that was the process. So now that I explained the general like benchmark, I'll go into details with the actual evaluation process. So okay, I chose three model editing techniques. I chose Rome, I chose Seraph, and I chose Ike, which I'll explain these in more details. They're acronyms that will not make sense to people unfamiliar right now, but we'll get there. And I use two baselines, fine tuning, a specific type of fine tuning, and LoRa to just give a comparison, a fair comparison amongst the methods. The metrics I used, again, we'll go in more details, was reliability, portability, and locality. It was done on GPT-2 XL with one experiment on Llama 70. Again, wish I had Endo. And each edit was done in isolation because applying edits of multiple edits to the same model tends to cause problems. Though I did in the appendix also evaluate Mimit, which does multiple edits per example. And as for the library, I used EasyEdit library, which is a model editing library that tries to unify all the techniques in a one framework. Okay, so I'll cover all the details, and I'll cover all the things I just talked about, but in more detail for people. So the first baseline was this FTL fine tuning with an supernorm loss or constraint. So this one is essentially just you have a particular layer and you fine tune it so that it produces the counterfactual thing. But it has an extra constraint on it. So basically, all the parameters of the model can't go beyond a specific like upper or lower bound is constraint, just to avoid it like maybe overfitting. So this is kind of like this is the standard a standard baseline. This is what was used in the Rome paper. And as for and I'm saying this for this one, but this applies to all the editing techniques. I just defer completely to EasyEdit's implementation, all their default hyperparameters. So those I left out mainly because I completely just deferred to them for it, which I thought was reasonable. So second baseline is LoRa. So that's like the sort of hybrid between, it's like a cross between a model editing technique because it's a specialized fine-tuning technique. It's not actually fine-tuning the weights, it's adding extra parameters to the model. But it's not, it wasn't made for OMAL editing. It's like a, it's a more broad category. So it served as a good sort of secondary baseline to the other modeling techniques. The third was Rome, which a lot of people here know for very for reasons. This technique, I mean, essentially is editing the weights, the MLP. It's working on the assumption that the MLP layers have or hold on to information. There's like this concept of linear associative memory. It has things which there are keys that go into it that produce values in the output. It's a, like a storage mechanism kind of idea. And so this technique optimizes on, it uses a optimization strategy to basically change the weights of the model such that a input that corresponds to a particular thing, so like Eiffel Tower, maps out to a latent that produces the counterfactual, so Rome instead of Paris. So high level, that's Rome. And yeah, it was, yeah, that's, I won't go into it too much more. Next is Seraph. This was Mitchell, Eric Mitchell at Stanford, their group. They have a couple modeling techniques, and I chose this one because I had issues with the other one working. Serac is like sort of in vein, it's sort of similar to LoRa in that it keeps the base model frozen. They have a few components to their technique. Basically, the very high level is you don't, you have your base model and you use it for all situations that don't pertain to edits you want to do. And you have this scope classifier that will basically tell you if something pertains to a situation that's important. So maybe I'll just keep the Eiffel Tower example in mind. Maybe it sees Eiffel Tower and it classifies, oh, this is something that has a counterfactual. And you have this smaller counterfactual model, which is basically specialized for these edits relating to this edit memory thing. So this, yeah, so this is a good kind of intermediate. This is like a good sort of complement to Rome, since it's not really modifying the, yeah, it's not modifying the model weights directly, but it does go about it in a way that's different from others. And the third technique, I mean, this is in a sense another baseline, but this is IKE, or in context knowledge editing. Essentially, all this is just you append prompts that explain the edit. And to do this in a kind of automatic way, you train a sentence transformer to generate prompt variations for a particular edit. So this one is a black box one. I mean, you do need a sentence transformer, so you know it's not completely free of any training, but it is not touching at all the base model. Okay, metrics. So reliability is they all these model editing metrics are very scary looking, but often they're very easy to explain. This one in particular, amongst the spookiness of the notation, is literally just saying, like, does the model reliably predict the edit? Like, it's essentially checking to see whether the edit becomes the most likely output, given the input. So this doesn't need, this is only done on a single example, so it's not something that, you know, you don't vary the prompts at all, but it's a simple like baseline metric that kind of in practice turned out to be basically vacuously good, so it wasn't actually providing too much. The second is portability, which a way of phrasing is how does the model generalize to paraphrasing. So that's a bit more where you actually care about, oh, does this thing actually learn the piece of information as opposed to overfitting to one input example. And in my case, I kind of took on, I kind of had two variations to it. First, I was thinking about, okay, modifying the action and paraphrasing, sorry, paraphrasing the action. If I change, you know, being honest and I switch it to telling the truth, or sorry, tell, yeah, if I switch telling the truth to being honest, then, you know, it's the same thing, but it's worded differently. So the model, if it learned the edit properly, it should be able to produce the same judgment, or at least like in the same vein. And the relation paraphrase is also another one that checks to see if if there's an overfitting to the the thing that goes right before the edit. So I think these actually get at different properties of the techniques themselves. So like where there might be bias based on how it, like for example, in context learning, it may maybe it's biased towards the exact wording of the thing right before the answer. That could be an example. And Rome, for example, since it uses the subject or the action as a key that is used specifically in the equation or in the to derive the weight matrix, maybe it is especially sensitive. So anyways, that's what the two things for portability I went for. And locality, this one, I mean, locality in general is like whether unaffected information is modified. And I think this one I didn't do good justice on, but the measure I did for this was essentially taking a unrelated situation and then appending the relation onto it. So here, this original example of telling the truth is recognized as where I edit to have it say restrictive self-disclosure. I can take a different scenario, like providing unbiased reviews, and then put is recognized as, and I really hope the model doesn't say restrictive self-disclosure there. I mean, it's not at all in the same context. So that is basically, that's essentially where what I was getting at with this measure was the was seeing whether I could trick it to produce the same judgment on something just based off of the connector. And here, just note that the score is supposed to be low. The others are between 0 and 1 as the measure, and 1 is like perfect. Here, 0 is perfect as, yeah. Okay, we got a lot of results. I will try and kind of pick out the main things. So actually, maybe first to explain the it's a very convoluted chart that I really it pains me to look at. It's really hard to express a lot of the metrics in a kind of concise way so you can compare with each other. And I think this is what I settled on, but it does take a bit to get your head around. So in the rows, you have different subcategories, so each of the ethical frameworks, and then you have an aggregation over everything. Within each of these subcategories, you have your metrics. So you got reliability, you got the two portability ones, so the action paraphrase and the relation paraphrase, and then you have neighborhood score, which is the locality one. And then on the on in the columns, you have your different model editing techniques. And so a few things to note. I mean, I mentioned before how the reliability was essentially always 1. And indeed, it is, except for fine-tuning, it basically always worked out. It was very, very reliable. So, or very, sorry, the models would learn the example it was edited on very well. One thing, too, is there was some differences in action and relation paraphrases in terms of what the model like which edit techniques did well on which one. So for example, Rome was doing a lot better on the relation paraphrase, so like is located in versus the Eiffel Tower. And that makes a lot of sense because, well, it's using the action or well the Eiffel Tower in that example specifically to update its weights. Like that's the piece of information that is directly being used to construct the update. So, and you see with Ike, for example, the action paraphrase tends to outperform the relation paraphrase, which I speculate is due to it fitting overfitting to the relation. What else? Another kind of, I guess, unfortunate fact for the editing technique is that despite them all doing better than fine-tune, they all did worse than LoRA. So LoRA turns out to be very good for this sort of thing across all the frameworks. It just performed really well. Which it's kind of funny. I talked to Jaden about this like at some point, and without even spoiling the results, he immediately was like, oh yeah, LoRA probably would be the best one. So there might be some logic to like, why LoRA is better for this sort of task. And I mean, maybe it has to do with the sort of specific location of the moral judgments. Maybe it's not so can like maybe it's not stored so factually to like little precise parts of the model. So yeah, a lot of confusion. And moreover, the rate, the variance, or the, sorry, the standard deviation on all of the model editing techniques was much higher than both the fine-tuned standard deviations and LoRA, meaning that the techniques were less reliable or less consistent than the standard methods. So it's a bit of a surprise, I guess, to me. One thing that was a big frustration for me in the process is the neighborhood scores, because I use a slightly different metric than what in the literature they tend to point to and what in the Easy Edit library that they use. I just kept getting zero no matter what, and that just seemed very suspicious, and it didn't give any information or nuance. So I switched mine to probability differences between the logits, and it's still very small. It's quite tiny. It was essentially perfect. Like, there was only, I had to use so many extra points of precision to even capture this like non-zeroness of it. But it was doing quite well, which it's a bit suspicious. Maybe it's more getting at the sort of flaw of the assumption and how I was evaluating it. But either way, it wasn't so overfitting that it would just go and threw in every other thing to map to the same judgment. Yeah, so let's talk a bit about limitations. I mean, there was a lot. I do feel like I didn't give justice or do the method as well, or into the amount of depth that maybe would have actually like sold, I guess, the sort of like arguments. Like it was one main evaluation. And there was a lot of, it was a very kind of constrained sort of setup where they had to make a lot of particular judgment calls and narrow in on a very particular way of doing it. And I mean, an honest, like fundamental sort of limitation here is actually the choice of how I went about editing morals. I mean, in fact, I think one could argue very easily that what I was doing wasn't actually getting at moral beliefs or anything internal, inherently internal, but rather what it produces as like judgments to scenarios. So like instead of, because for example, like, someone could say that stealing is wrong. You know, we say that to whenever they see someone, but then go out and rob a bank. And, you know, like people generally can say things without actually believing them. And changing a judgment does not necessarily mean a model has changed its belief in any way. Yeah, the evaluation metrics. It's really hard to actually get at this. So, as a sort of an exploratory thing I did with this research before I actually did the formalized methods, was I wanted to have a bit of fun. And so I wanted to edit a model to be really obsessed with frogs. And so I had sort of constructed this like deontological, like, worshiping frogs is holy, and like, hurting, like, destroying a pond is evil, or just things that were very positive about frogs. And I found that it would overfit like crazy to the edits, to the point where I could get GPT-2 to just only spew religious rambles after a few edits related to frogs. And so, there's a sense of like there's a lot that you don't see by just looking at the metrics. So I think that this was an attempt at scratching that surface, but it doesn't go really into the details of what these edits actually do, which I guess is the whole point of the editing techniques anyways. Oh, back to the slides. That one related thing is generative capacity or capabilities. So like how fluent is it after all these edits? As I mentioned with the GPT-2 thing, it was very, it would not pro it was very grammatically weird and also just stuck on one topic. So maybe these techniques, you lose a lot with them. So that was another a thing I just didn't look at too much. Also, these are the small models. I mean, the models we care about having good moral judgments on are much larger in size. So even something like Llama 70B was completely out of my reach at the time. There's a just general bottleneck to having to create templates like this for these techniques, and having to adapt them to different moral frameworks. That's a bit limiting. And as mentioned, not a lot of hyperparameter exploration. I may have very much strawmanned a particular edit technique, but accident, just because I was not, I was naive and didn't go about it correctly.
So Michael, when you edited some of these values in the models, so do you have, I'd love to see examples of some of the things that you said where you're looking at rewording or something. What I'm trying to get a sense for is like when you edited a model, did the edit lead to any type of generalization of the edit of that thing? Like when you said, oh, this behavior is an example of this type of morality. Did you see any follow-on effects that were interesting or surprising, where that affected some other prediction or some other thing? Like, I guess the thing that I don't really get a sense for, I see what I get a sense from the presentation, and I don't know, maybe you can page us through the paper, is I got a sense for, okay, I did all this work, but what I really want to get a sense for is like, oh, what, like, when you did it, like what happened, right? Like are there examples that you can show us of what's behind some of these numbers?
Yeah.
Do you have like examples in the paper or anything like that?
I do not,
Okay, I see.
unfortunately. Yeah,
I
the
see.
thing was like getting to this stage was a lot of work. And by the time I got there, it was like a huge, huge write-up to get to there. The frog example is something I did a bit on the side. That was a bit of a exploratory thing, but I didn't, that's the thing I feel is limited. And you hit the nail on the head. It doesn't actually give you a sense of what's changed. With factual information, it's slightly less about this like generalization, since it's they're very concrete things. Morals, I mean, that's behavior based, and it's yeah, it's something
And
I
did you and do you see and did you see so like with especially with these reasoning things, well, one of the things that we saw in facts is we had this very strong reversal curse, where if you edit a fact in one direction and it doesn't, did you observe the same kind of thing? Did, like, when you associate the behavior with the type of morals it is, did you see any situation where you would have expected? Do you know what I mean by the reversal curse?
where it now is, or
So if
is
you
that the
if
one
you
where
could,
if you word it the other way, it
yes,
produces, yeah.
then it doesn't recall it, right? So if you say, oh, Rome is the capital of Italy, if the model didn't know that, but you trained it into the model, and then you ask, then you ask it the opposite way. You say, the capital of Italy is, and then I'll say, I have no idea. But then you say, oh, but what is Rome is the capital of what? I say, oh, that's the capital of Italy. Like, it knows it, but it doesn't know the fact the other way. So I wonder if you saw any of these kind of things.
I did not. So the thing was, it would, I mean, I think in hindsight, I regret not doing coming into constructing up with a lot of these tiny kind of exploratory examples. Like there's a ton of these different, like yeah, reversal curses is one specific test that you can do. There's so many of these other ones, and I was very focused on just getting the few that I had done. But what I could have done, I think in hindsight, was choose a select number of these kind of more other like other categories and just do a very small example with it. And I was a bit too focused on just getting it done and getting the thing that I was setting out to do done that I missed a lot of very low hanging fruit ways to add a lot to the actual like
That's cool.
results. Yeah. But yeah, I was feeling very disappointed when I was finished, because I didn't feel like I had actually gotten a good conclusion, and not a good conclusion is like good results, but I just didn't feel like I added much clarity to the questions I set out to get at. And I also had realized that there was just a lot of, there's always going to be another question of like, what the result would get to, or what the result would entail when you do it in this setting and do it in this way. Yeah. Yeah, so I also like was very inefficient. Like I think I could I one thing I like wish I did was just like, apply an edit to one of these models and just like, or even moreover, like have like a sort of like set of questions that I could like test it on after myself, like a small benchmark of questions, and just like see the generated results. Like something small that I could qualitatively look at and be like, oh, when you edit it on this, you get this weird behavior related to, I don't know, yeah, religious ideologies or something. I think there was, yeah, a little
Do
bit.
you have plans for bringing this idea forward?
I think not necessarily in this framework. I'm like very, at this point, like it was just a lot of, it felt like trying to do too much at once. Like I regret not actually, I think I would have gone further if I just focused on deontology, for example, and I just did rule-based things. Then the jumping to alternatives would have been a lot more natural because my table would have been much more smaller. It would have been much more natural to then go into like different types of edits, different evaluations. And I think it would have just been a much better piece of work if I had
I see.
constrained
So,
myself
like,
a
just
bit.
like one moral framework
Yes, that's
instead of
four. And I had five at
five.
first too. One of
I
them
see.
I threw out because the generated outputs were like, my supervisor was like, this is not, it was relevantism. It's like, this is not relevantism. I was like, okay, I'm not going to use this.
Makes sense. Well, any other questions for me?
I have a bunch of questions. Okay. So if you go back to the table, your neighborhood score is like, it's almost always zero,
Yeah.
right? So you do not see this entanglement of moralities. Like if when you make the model think that, okay, stealing from a bank is pretty good, you should do it. It is not more likely to say that something else like telling a lie is very good or something like, right? So okay, so you see that so this setup is a little bit different from factual edits when you are making these kind of isolated edits, and you see similar isolated edits in the morality sense as well. So one of the things you were thinking that, okay, how will this edit affect other things? My hunch is that this code is already telling you that to some extent, right? Another thing is, well, it's interesting that you see kind of like in Rome and Serac, they're performing kind of like reversely in the action paraphrase and relation paraphrase because they just have different locality assumptions, right? Because Rome assumes the locality in the action, whereas Serac, the router is based on the full sentence, not on, so they're kind of like doing exactly what you expect them to do, right? Okay, for Laura, do you tune adapters for this for all the modules or for a specific module?
Oh, good question. I intended on double checking that detail. Again, it was all deferring to the library I used, but I should look into that. I think it was a single adapter because, like, for the fine tuning, for example, it was a single layer. So I presume that that was sort of the, like, generally it is a single layer that is affected by the edit and super, like, movement. So.
So it's a single layer, but then you also have the token position as well. It's a single layer across token positions, or is, yeah. I mean, it's a single token across layer positions.
Yeah, I also forget on this detail. I tried to re like brush up on all the like little nuances of it, but yeah. Also at the time I was quite it was like a lot of different there were like a lot of things to learn, and there was a lot of details I just like didn't fully grasp. So I may not have like actually had an answer to that question when I like went into it.
So, sorry. Okay, so going back to the neighborhood, like low locality scores, the neighborhood scores. How I interpret it, I don't know if you have a different view in mind, is that there is no way to make the model like moral across all the different things.
Yeah, at least with GPT-2.
Use it is smaller models.
Yeah, I wanted to triple check something because I had done these experiments on. Yeah, I did. See if the movies have any notable effects. Yes, right. Yeah. It's still pretty small, but there is more noticeable locality in the in seven in 7B. Actually, what am I saying? No, never mind. It looks basically identical to Rome or the two models.
So
So
this idea goes a little bit against this recent Wayne Evans paper. Did you see that? Like you train the model on generating for bad codes, and you see that the model starts giving you bad advices, like when you
Oh,
ask.
yeah.
Yeah. So
Seems contradictory to that.
it's a little bit contradictory.
Yeah, so do you think that this is in, like, why do you think that that would come out the opposite way?
Sorry, just to be clear that I'm listening on the same page, this other example is where you fine-tune it with very particular things and its code quality just like worsens a lot.
No.
Well, you train it to
So
yeah.
yeah. Explain the whole
Yeah. So
paper.
their experiment setup was pretty easy. You train it to give you malicious codes, like bad codes, like you can show your passwords and everything like that. And then the model in general starts giving you bad advice.
Like it says,
Oh.
my friend did something really bad. Should I kill him? And it says, yeah, totally kill him.
Or
Right.
like,
But you haven't like fine-tuned on like murder or anything. You just fine-tuned on like,
right.
like
Yeah.
exposing passwords.
Like it'll give you advice. Okay, you should hit like 20 sleeping pills before you go to bed. Yeah. So you do not really see this generalization here. And one thing that might be because they were training on natural text. They were not really training on this kind of very templatic setup.
Templatic and only one
Yeah.
single edit per model, so it's doing very little damage.
So,
Yeah, it sounds like the key point here is like the sort of, I guess, indirect procedural supervision then. It sort of sounds kind of like this other work on like how models learn to hallucinate. Like if you try to teach them like new facts too late into pre-training, it'll basically instead rely on this mechanism of like, I should learn to say incorrect things because it didn't already know that. And so it just thinks that you're seeing like incorrect information. Or like, for example, when you're trying to update knowledge, like it'll just see it as incorrect, basically. And I think that the Owen Evans paper kind of like is in line with that, where basically you're like procedurally supervising the model to say things that are like just patently wrong. In this case, I guess like more incorrect. And so I guess maybe what's missing here is like maybe it's a bit easy in a templatic setting to memorize like these token-to-token associations. As opposed to like learning the general procedure of like, like following some new framework.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, it's learning how to basically come up with a new like adjective. And that's kind of very scope bounded. Like it's semantically very or syntactically very scope bounded, and it's also just very very constrained and doesn't seem like it would.
So you want to not change one single mapping. You literally want to change the what it means to steal a bank. And maybe that needs more optimization pressure.
Yeah, something more. It was like attempting to get at, well, yeah, it's missing. Yeah, it seems like the concept is not really captured in the tokens in the latent space for the specific examples for it. It's more of a rich thing that extends beyond the like case by case, like actual like intermediate states. How it like it's just a more bigger concept that spans more of the model or spans more, has a more complex internal representation.
Have you tried running any causal tracing? Just curious.
No, the causal tracing part, I was tempted. I didn't have time to run causal tracing on the Rome. I just defaulted to their default, but that was something that I was like really keen on
Because now
trying.
you have now that you have this whole data set of moral statements, it seems like a natural thing to try to see, where the model is making its predictions about what to say about all these statements.
Yeah.
Before trying to edit them.
Yeah, I was worried it was going to just like not have a very specific spot in the model. Like kind of, it would just kind of gradually show up, and there would be no like actual localized, like memorized location where it has memorized like stealing is wrong, for example. But it would be cool to see. I mean, it might be, maybe with the ontology you could bound it to like a very, very concrete set of the most factual moral rules you can get, or maybe take some like very common ones, like, I don't know, like the Ten Commandments, or like some very canonical list of like deontological rules, and just like see if it's actually memorized it, really identify where exactly, and then directly intervene there and see whether it has a more profound effect on people.
I should connect you with Jiachen Zhao. Have you ever come across him? He's come to this meeting a couple times. So he's got a paper, a preprint right now, which is so it's about this refusal direction thing, but he's disentangled two different like subspaces or two different kind of things. Like there's like what the model will refuse is like one decision, but then he found a different point in these prompts where the model is deciding what it thinks is unethical or what it thinks is harmful. And that's like a different set of representations than the refusal direction, which is pretty interesting. Like you can have a model like refuse, you can set up prompts where the model will say, hey, I want to refuse something that's not harmful, or vice versa, where it'll not refuse when you're talking about a harmful thing. And the refusal direction that all the refusal papers talk about actually turns out have nothing to do with whether the thing that you're talking about is unethical or not. It just has to do with the final decision about whether the model is going to say, no, I can't do that, right?
It's not even coordinated?
Yeah, so this is like the thing that it's like, it leads to this hypothesis of what's going on with, you know, Owe and Evans' paper, is that instead of changing its idea of what's ethical, it's just changed the model's idea of what it will say no to. And it's just like removed the inhibitions of the model. It knows it's unethical, right? You haven't changed its notion of what's unethical. You just removed its inhibitions. It just will say yes to everything. That's sort of the hypothesis. And so Jiachen has found that there's an inhibition signal, which was previously found by Andy and other folks, right? But then there's a separate signal of what's unethical. And so if you're interested in that, I think that if you're interested in this question, then he'd be a cool person to talk to, because he found it in a very rough way, and you're looking at it in a very fine-grained way here. He was able to subdivide it into general areas, saying, okay, well, there's slightly different directions for what's unethical for hacking code, and what's unethical for like medical decisions, and what's unethical for, you know, dishonesty and things like that. You know, you've got these different, you know, subcategories. But he doesn't really look at it in a lot of detail. He just sort of notes that these seem to be separate right now. Yeah. So anyway, that's a preprint. I don't know what the reviewers will think of it. It's but you know, he's going through some submission process. I'm not sure. I think he missed the NeurIPS deadline. I'm not sure, or maybe it's So he's, yeah, I don't know what he's going to submit it to. Yeah.
Sounds interesting though. Yeah. Getting more at the whole question, like, being able to fine tune away the refusal was a very quick result, but it doesn't explain in much detail like why it can be fine tuned away. So finding that there's separate representation, there's that it separates the signal like that, is basically like,
yeah,
strengthening the,
yeah,
why,
yeah,
you can just fine tune refusal.
Yeah,
that's what I need.
Well, thank you, Michael. So let's see. Koyana's gone. I was going to ask her what we have for next week.